Hi, everybody. It's Bean, and welcome to an all-new episode of Great Moments in Weed History. Wishing you a happy Weedness Day if you're listening to this episode on the day it was released, and reminding you that, of course, every day is Weedness Day, as long as you got some weed. I'm incredibly excited to share this Weeds episode with you all, because we are going to once and for all answer the question, can hemp save the world? Spoiler alert, yes it can. And I say that with confidence after speaking with our guest today, who is someone who has fully envisioned a hempy future for humanity, one where the cannabis plant in all forms helps us to decentralize and relocalize our energy production, our economic systems, our ecology, and our connection to Mother Earth. If you're thinking we must be talking with the man Jack Herrer, rhymes with terror, the Hemperer himself, I've got some unfortunate news for you, which is that he passed away quite a few years ago. The good news is we do have an entire episode of Great Moments in Weed History in the archive called Jack Herrer Green Pilled the World. So if you know the man or you know the strain, but you don't know the story, please, please go back and listen to that one. It was recorded live in Los Angeles. Definitely a favorite. But today, we are going to talk with one and only living legend, Doug Fine. He's a friend of the podcast, a friend of mine, and a self-described solar-powered goat herder, a comedic investigative journalist, and a leading advocate for regenerative farming in all forms, including, of course, cannabis slash hemp. Doug's books, and tell me if you detect a pattern here, include American Hemp Farmer, his latest, Hemp Bound, the book in which he outlined this vision of a hemp-powered future for the world, an excellent book called Too High to Fail. That was one of the first comprehensive looks at the new legal weed economy, and a bestseller called Farewell My Subaru that is fun and funny and informative, and they're all worth giving a read. Even more exciting is the fact that when it comes to hemp farming, Doug doesn't just talk the talk, he stalks the stalk. Hemp stalks, that is. We are talking about propaganda by the deed, or maybe propaganda by the seed, because as you're going to hear, Doug is talking to us live and direct from his family farm off the grid in New Mexico, where he raises goats and grows hemp, and he even teaches from there an online course called Regenerative Hemp, From Soil to Seed to Sale. So if you find yourself inspired to go out and say, hemp, hemp, hooray, and get into the hemp-growing world yourself, he can guide you through every step of that process. Doug, in his books, has outlined this vision of the future, not only answering the question, can hemp save the world, but showing us exactly how we can go about it. Speaking of saving things, if you want to help keep this podcast going, if you want to make sure that this ongoing project to preserve and share true cannabis history with the world goes on indefinitely, we really, really listen to my voice. Really need you to come out and support us on Patreon, and it's very easy to do. All you have to do is go to greatmomentsinweedhistory.com, and you can give us as little as a dollar a month. You can be five times as cool as that and put five on it, or for a little more, you can get a signed copy of my book, How to Smoke Pot Properly, delivered right to your door. Best of all, you know, now you've already heard me say that there is a new episode of this podcast every weed on Weedness Day, or every week on Wednesday, if you want to be a square about it. But that is only true for our supporters on Patreon, because wherever you're listening to this episode, you're only going to get one every other weed, every other weedness day, because every other weed on every other weedness day, I know this is getting confusing, but bear with me, we are a Patreon-only show, because that is where we are having the secret seshes. I shouldn't even be telling you about it, but otherwise, how are you going to know to come and join us on Patreon to get these incredibly cool episodes that I've started doing, where I'm actually talking to our supporters on Patreon, and we are getting lit from the jump, and it is just a more informal, chill vibe way to get to know all the cool people who are part of this GMIWHPU, the Great Moments in Weed History podcast universe, which is just becoming more and more of a mutually supportive, cool, engaged community online. We'd love for you to be a part of it. And the biggest thing you get is, first of all, the video version of every single episode. Right now, you can see me holding up this J that you know I'm going to spark up right before the theme song. But you also will get all of these secret seshes. And there are just such cool people in this community. So far, I've talked with a bud tender. I've talked with a medical doctor who teaches classes in cannabis. We have a cool weedy conversation coming up with a fiber freak, and I'll leave that where it is for now. You can find out what that is in a couple of weeds on a couple of weedness days from now. But I wanted to highlight a conversation that just posted last weed, our most recent secret sesh, because it really touched my heart and really reminded me of why this podcast is worth let's just say the time and effort and love that I'm putting into it. The rewards are not always as financial as I would like them to be. It's something that I'm working on. But when I realize that people like my guest for this most recent sesh, John, are out there listening and feeling a connection to this community, I know that it is all worth it, no matter what else. And, you know, first and foremost, this was an incredible secret sesh just because John is a super chill, funny, and cool person to share some weed with. John also shared with me and all of us in on the secret seshes the extremely inspiring story of how he became a public advocate for medical cannabis, and in particular for those who, like himself, have a condition called Friedreich's ataxia. Now, according to the National Organization for Rare Disorders, Friedreich's ataxia, or FA as he calls it, is a genetic neurodegenerative movement disorder that affects about one in every 50,000 people. John was kind enough to share with us on the secret sesh not only how cannabis helps him treat and manage the condition, but he also recalled for us the truly great moment when he himself spoke out for the first time, loud and proud, at a public hearing held by the FDA to tell the government and to tell everyone in his community how much cannabis has helped him in his life, in his treatment of this condition, and just makes him happy.
So the years went by, and like I kept smoking and like kept hiding and like lying to my doctors about it. They would always say, keep doing what you're doing. So in my mind, it was like, well, this doctor just told me to keep smoking weed. And let's go to 2017, which will bring us to really the main great moment of this rambling story.
No, you are on point, and I am hold on one second, because if we're getting to our great moment, I gotta...
Yeah.
All right, lay it on me.
So in 2017, the FDA, they're having a patient-focused meeting. So all day, like, people gave stories about their lives and the pain that FA is causing them. And then it was up to me, my turn with the microphone. And so I gave a talk about weed and how it can really help and in specific ways.
What were those ways? What are the ways that you find it helps?
Well, I actually, let's read the speech right now.
Herbert, this is a recreation of a great moment in weed history. I'm thrilled.
Hi, I'm John Sarnsek. I currently do a lot to manage my symptoms. The one I want to talk about today is cannabis. The benefits are wide-ranging. Everything from neuropathic pain relief to muscle relaxing to emotional and mental restoration. Cannabis helps with sleep. Anyone with FA will tell you, if you're not well rested, the ataxia is more pronounced. It can reduce dependency on antidepressants, painkillers, and other potentially harmful prescription drugs. Medical marijuana has been legalized in 29 states plus DC. Yet there hasn't been an investigation into its benefits with FA. It's not a cure, but we could be using a specifically cultivated strain that targets a specific symptom right now. With the doctor's guidance, this stuff can help us. We need to know how. We need a scientific investigation. Thank you.
You can hear the rest of my conversation with John and get access to all the secret sessions if you will just join us on Patreon at greatmomentsinweedhistory.com. We're trying to get to 420 supporters by April 20th, 420 of this year. So join us now and you can get in on all the secret sessions. You can go back and watch video versions of dozens of episodes and you can be a part of this growing family, all at greatmomentsinweedhistory.com. And if you don't have five to put on it, or even one to put on it, I feel like you got one to put on it. Come on, man. Come on, lady. Come on, non-binary stoner. I'm passing the hat here. It's that uncomfortable moment where the band's been playing for a while and now we're passing the hat and looking you right in the eye. Are you digging what we're putting out? If so, we need a little of that green energy. But if you don't have it right now, please subscribe to the podcast, leave us a review, tell your friends. That all helps us spread the word because we are, of course, shadow banned and regular banned and double banned, and we're on triple secret probation with this podcast. The world does not want this information about this plant out there, so we need you to help spread the word. Now, couple of listener notes before we get into this episode with Doug Fine. First, maybe obvious, maybe new information to you, but hemp and cannabis are actually the exact same plant. They are just bred for different purposes. You know, we tend to refer to cannabis or weed as the medicinal, psychoactive strains of the cannabis plant, while strains of cannabis that were grown for industrial uses like fiber or seed production for food, those are known as hemp. And hemp was outlawed in the United States federally in 1937, right along with cannabis. Check out our episode about ultimate human paraquat Harry J. Anslinger for more on that story. But the good news, at least for hemp, is that in 2018, the U.S. Farm Bill officially ended federal prohibition of hemp with a THC level of 0.3% or less. So that is a huge sea change that has led to a big movement of hemp growing, a lot of it for these sort of CBD-rich cannabis that you can access yourself no matter where you live. And of course, we always recommend doing so from our supporters at Tweedle Farms. That's tweedlefarms.com. You can get CBD-rich cannabis, gummies, tinctures, topicals, all farm direct. And if you use the promo code Great Moments, you will get a really nice discount from our friends up in Oregon. But in the meantime, the in-between time, the green time, for today's episode, I've got a nice, long, flowering sativa strain, because that is the kind of cannabis I associate with my friend Doug Fine, because that's what we were smoking when we first met and became friends at the Cannabis Cup in Amsterdam, I'm thinking more than a decade ago. Time flies when you're having fun, kind of like time flies when you're having fun. And shout out to Doug for being such a great advocate of this plant and a good friend to me. I greatly enjoyed catching up with him. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation as well, except and unless, and with the single caveat that you might be saying to yourself right now, with your inside voice, very quietly, hoping nobody realizes, like, oh, this is about to start, and I'm not high at all. I don't even have anything ready to blaze. And I know we're about to hear the theme song, and we'll be into the episode, and everybody's going to be lit, and I'm going to be way behind, and I'm kind of forgetting. Don't worry. You know what you got to do. Well, first of all, just take a deep breath. That feels good, even without the weed. And then hit pause. Easy peasy. And use that time at your leisure to roll yourself a joint like the one I'm holding up to the camera, or to split a blunt, or to pack a bong, or to endabulate a dab, or to eat as much edibles as you think it's wise to eat, and then wait an hour and a half before you eat any more. No matter how you get that weed into you, the one thing I can promise you is that when you are ready, we'll be ready for another great moment in weed history. You know, it's no exaggeration to say this podcast runs on coffee and weed. And lately, the coffee has been top shelf because of our new sponsor, Vigilante Coffee. I grind my beans daily, no pun intended, and I do the whole pretentious hipster pour over thing every morning. And I gotta say, I really enjoy thinking about where my coffee came from and how it was grown and processed, just like weed. And just like weed, it's worth it to get the best coffee you can afford. And the good news is, if you brew your own at home, really good coffee is an affordable luxury. That's why I'm thrilled to have Vigilante Coffee on the podcast and in my mug each and every morning. Vigilante is a specialty coffee roaster that sources their beans directly from small, award-winning farms around the world and then roasts them to perfection. They support ending the war on drugs, and they want to support this podcast too, because they believe that all you really need is coffee and weed. Amen. So treat yourself to a bag of their Golden Bean Award-winning Dank Blend, which has just returned for its fourth year. Dank is 80% Guatemalan and 20% Ethiopian. Brew that up nice and strong and pair it with a puff or two of good weed in the morning, and I guarantee you will be up and at them. To learn more or to order their amazing coffee, check out their website, vigilantecoffee.com, or you can visit one of their cafes. And if you buy a pound of those beans, well, please tell them Beans sent you. vigilantecoffee.com. Doug Fine, it is a pleasure to have you with us here at Great Moments in Weed History. I'm excited to catch up with you after a few years. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. Even if we didn't have this long history, it would be an honor to be on this show. So thank you for having me. From the middle of nowhere in New Mexico.
Yeah, right on. More goats than people, I think, in your life, probably, on the ranch.
Definitely more goats than people. And the people that I see, and this is one of the keys, are generally the people I want to see.
It sounds like success by a good metric. You. So we want to talk on this episode about the history of hemp. And I also want to talk about the vision for a hemp-based future that you first outlined in your book, Hemp Bound. But let's start with the hemp present. Where are you at in your hemp journey right now?
Thanks. That's a great place to start. And it is almost time to start as we're recording kind of what in New Mexico, high desert is late winter already. So it's thinking about getting the goat poop on the soil and all that personally. But higher altitude, one of the things I'm most excited about in hemp is a variety that I've been developing for about 6 years has been shown in a New Mexico State University study to be phytoremediative, that is soil cleaning, cleaning up radioactivity in soil. I'd say the other thing that I really feel great about personally in hemp is cultivating for food. I'm trying to demonstrate hemp these days as part of polyculture, just another plant in the garden, as it's always been for most of the last, 12,000 years, well before sedentary agriculture had fully set in. Anthropologists call hemp a camp follower, the type of seed that was stuck in a pouch to be planted at seasonal camps because it was valuable for everything from strong fibers for sandals and roofs to the superfood in the seed to ego, minimization and relaxation from the healthy flowers. So it goes way back. And I love growing for food specifically. Basically having enough hemp seeds when the deer leave our small home hemp garden alone for a family of four for the year.
I think there's a lot of talk now about hemp as high CBD hemp that people are using as more of a medicine. But you're kind of going back to the Jack Herer idea that hemp can go well beyond that and save the world, if you will. And that harkens back to our much older relationship with this plant as humans. So, in your study of the plant, where do you see that hemp-human relationship beginning? And let's kind of chart the evolution and then the de-evolution of human hemp relations.
Everything we're going to be talking about hemp, I hope folks will also just map onto this idea that instead of petroplastics and other kind of toxics, humanity was able to function for a long time only with what the earth provided. And even through industrial revolution and everything, plastics were 20th century. But in the beginning, we touched on a little bit earlier, the camp follower idea, the fact that there were a series of valuable seeds that people all over the world carried and developed and cultivated even before the arguable misstep of sedentary agriculture and its successors, kings and lawyers and stuff or whatever. Betraying a personal bias, David, I think we're supposed to be semi-nomadic shamanistic primates. But but cannabis was part of it, even when we were that. And in our body, we are, of course, because of the receptors. So we're great friends with this plant. We love this plant. It keeps us healthy and it makes great roofs and sandals. So it's always been in our lives. I'm really lucky to be making a TV show based on my latest book, American Hemp Farmer. And I got invited to Mount Vernon to film the first hemp planting at Mount Vernon, George Washington's estate, in 100 years. And it was fun filming in all these colonial clothes and harvesting with a really sharp sickle. I cut my thumb and all that kind of stuff. But bottom line, no bones about it. They are proud. The people in charge of George Washington's legacy are proud of the importance that hemp played in this founding father's life.
You mentioning Mount Vernon and George Washington as a hemp farmer, of course, brings to light one cultural touchstone, which is that scene in Dazed and Confused, where the perhaps most dazed and most confused of all the characters is factually right on when he's talking about how George Washington grew that shit at Mount Vernon, man.
George Washington, man, he was in a cult. And the cult was into aliens, man. You didn't know that?
No.
Oh, man, they were way into that type of stuff, man.
George Tote Weed.
Man. Absolutely, George Tote Weed. Are you kidding me, man? He grew fields of that stuff, yeah, man. That's what I'm talking about. Fields.
He grew that shit up in Mount Vernon, man.
Mount Vernon, man. He grew it all over the country, man. He had people growing it all over the country, you know? The whole country back then was getting high. Let me tell you, man, because he knew. He was onto something, man. He knew that it would be a good cash crop for the southern states, man. So he grew fields of it, man. But you know what? Behind every good man, there's a woman. And that woman was Martha Washington, man. And every day George would come home, she'd have a big fat bowl waiting for him, man, when he'd come in the door, man. She was a hip lady.
And then I think the other presence in the revival of hemp, at least in America, that we really should recognize is the writing and the work and the advocacy of Jack Herer, rhymes with terror. We have a whole episode of this program about him, so I'll just touch on that. But the chord that he struck was not talking about the future of hemp so much as uncovering the obscured history of it. And so, kind of to people who may not understand that history, how was hemp being used prior to prohibition?
Food and fiber are two huge things. Before I talk about maybe one or two of my favorite kind of ancient and modern applications for each of those, I just want to do that nod to Jack Herer that you mentioned, because like everyone, I had and read it and enjoyed Emperor. And so it is incredible how the truths of that book have held up. And it's also, even to me as a journalist, what other histories get obscured, as you put it, you know, it was a eye opener. But as for the fiber, you know, for the last several thousand years, it's been the workaday clothing and the workaday paper. So draft, but not final copy of the Declaration of Independence. Farming clothes, but not what was worn, receiving company or whatever. Switching to food, how could people not have always eaten hemp? One time, an Iranian graduate student told me that when he was growing up, hot roasted hemp seeds kind of in like a paper wrapping with some salt and oil on top was the go-to, like, food going to soccer practice. You know, they weren't in his day, they weren't ripping open Doritos. They were going to the stand and buying it. And in Persian, it means Shah Dinah, means the king of seeds. I love the superfood side of it so much. It's can be 30%+ protein. And I can tell you, just these few plants that I grow at home, they're just these giant, they look like, evergreen bushes. They're so dense and so much seed. A family can really jack up its protein, and it's really great in chicken feed, goat feed, all our livestock. You know, I've been filming all that for the show too. Like, our livestock loves it. A cool modern use is the phytoremediation. You know, I'll stop there and just say it's a major thing. The earth soil needs to be cleaned up from pesticides, herbicides, synthetic chemicals, saline in pumped water in places like California, and hemp is just a remarkable tool for that.
Yeah, that really gets into the hemp can save the world framing that Jack Herer brought into the discussion and backed up with a lot of the historical record, and I think got people really excited about this plan again. Of course, it took a lot of activism to enact those changes. And something else interesting that you touched on, I want to highlight is, you know, just as we have different strains, different genetic varieties of cannabis that we smoke or, you know, use to get high or however you want to ingest it, there was this long, long tradition of different varietals of hemp, and the breeding of those varietals would be a very similar process to creating sour diesel, because you liked its properties. So what do you know of that history, and how much of that was lost to prohibition?
All over the world, just about, people developed specific varieties for their specific needs, and you can develop them pretty quickly. Farming, you know, there's obviously a huge spiritual component to farming, and I have really become attached to it and talking about it and writing about it, because farming is a different thing. It requires presence every day. And one thing I can tell you with as much certainty as anyone could say in this life, is if you are there in your field present, loving your plants and loving the soil year round. I mean, this is the time of year where I gather mycelium to build up the beneficial fungus and the soil from native fungus, not from what my friend Chris Trump calls a bugs in a jug ordered in a plastic jug from wherever. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's better than toxic monoculture, but you know, build your own microbes. So the plants, I don't consider myself an expert farmer, but the plants really give back and they respond to what is being asked, you know, and you can grow a variety that is very strong, promising fiber and a huge seed producer. Some would say, okay, but then that can also be a cannabinoid plant. I use the seeded flower from the variety that I've been developing in a commercial product. And it's about cannabinoid ratio. It's not about milligrams per unit. It's about what the natural plant is providing. And I love it. I find it to be what I want it to be, which is a relaxing bath oil and massage oil. There is, without a doubt, going on throughout history all over, distinct Northern Africa versus let's say Europe or China, but everybody is developing cannabis as they need it. And often there's a variety that does it all, because what we talk about as the hemp cannabis split is, it's such an arbitrary and recent phenomenon. It's really a non-issue. The plant has always been one plant. So Kentucky farmers in the 30s, right? They're basically mainly growing for fiber. But was the flower doing something if you smoked it? Probably. My guess would be 6 to 8% THC. Nobody was worried about THC level or considering that hemp to be something different from cannabis. I'm interested in what you think about this theory, David. I'll throw it back to you here. People older than you and I, who were friends with the cannabis, let's say in cannabis plant in the 60s and 70s, I get this commonly. I don't know if you hear this. It's wonderful going into these dispensaries and getting 28%, 32% flower sensimilla. But there was something about the seeded flowers. It was less edgy. There was a sense of social relate. And some of this has to do with sativa versus indica, whatever. So what occurred to me when I keep hearing these stories is maybe just as a human woman's body changes hormonally when pregnant, fertilized hemp flower might not be soaring in THC, but might have that natural balance that humans have selected for thousands of years. Is that going to be commercially viable? I don't know. But let's put it this way for a direct question. Would you rather burn sticky scentsy any day, or could you see the value of smoking seeded flower?
I've smoked a lot of seeded flower, most of it in my younger years. I certainly came up on, you know, compressed brick weed coming out of Mexico, and shout out to all the farmers down there, especially of the mid-90s. Thank you very much. You know, not knocking it. I was grateful to have it and have warm memories of it. And even more recently, on a trip to Costa Rica, I was blessed with what was being grown up in the mountains by, you know, and essentially the indigenous people of Costa Rica. And, you know, you know it, you don't need a third party certifier to tell you it's organic, because they're certainly not buying a bunch of chemicals, you know. And I find that cannabis extremely pleasant. I think, you know, another aspect of it is to grow sensimilla, which means Spanish for without seeds, you're preventing the, as you said, the fertilization. You're preventing this natural process in the plant's life. And so it's continuing to produce resin in hopes of capturing pollen from the air. So to be a bit crude, these are the female plants that we consume for medicine and for psychoactive fun. They're getting, increasingly sexually frustrated in a way, and we are reaping that oil, psychoactive element of the plant. I could certainly see the case that that might give you a different experience. I think what's really interesting to me is a study just came out, and I'm going to be pretty general because I don't want to misrepresent it, but that in essence said sun-grown cannabis has a more diverse and representative chemical composition of what the plant produces, whereas cannabis, and this was a study where they took genetically identical seeds and grew out the plants outdoors under the sun and indoors under an artificial light. And potency aside, because, you know, if something's twice as potent, but you take two puffs instead of one, you know, it's that simple. It's not as important as people make it out. But the idea that sun-grown cannabis, which people older than ourselves, you know, my grandparents ate organic food, not because they were trendy, but because there was no non-organic food. And the people of the, you know, the cannabis enthusiasts of the 1980 or before, it was all sun-grown. And I do think that, you know, now, just very recently, we have some science to show what I think people of our orientation towards the plant have long said. You know, this plant evolved to eat sunlight, not to eat a narrow spectrum of artificial light. So I think that this it's all very complicated. And I think anybody who's never smoked seeded weed, don't turn your nose up at it, you know. You probably shouldn't be getting it at a dispensary for the prices that you're paying, but if you were just growing some plants outdoors and they got seeded, you're going to have an enjoyable time picking the seeds out, and you're going to have something good to smoke. To shift gears a little, what I loved about your book, Hemp Bound, when it came out, for me, I felt like the hemp activism up until that point, in the Jack Herer tradition, was really educational in terms of this obscured history and the uses of the plant that were documented but later denied. And of course, we look at the film Hemp for Victory that the federal government made to promote hemp growing as part of the World War II effort. So decades after they outlawed the plant. But in your book, you outlined a vision of the future of hemp. So not can hemp save the world, but what would a world that embraced hemp as a means to alleviating these self-inflicted calamities of our existence on the planet? Perhaps you can take us through how you got involved in that sort of future casting approach to hemp and where that led you.
Thanks for that. While I was researching an earlier book called Too High to Fail about cooperatives of cannabis farmers in the Emerald Triangle, which was fun embedding there, moving the family out for a year to the Redwoods. While I was researching that book, the most progressive of the farmers in the Mendocino sort of community with which I was embedded, we're talking about centralizing for a regional group of farmers processing, which would be really easy for a lot of reasons. You know, one inspection, you know what I mean? And uniformity in terms of if people are using certain strain names and professional equipment and all that kind of stuff. Good accounting, all of that business. And so while we were kind of having this conversation, one of the farmers said, and by the way, nobody does anything with the stocks. There's stocks, like any kind of cannabis implant, they're just there after the harvest. So that spurred me to start really looking first at cannabis implant other than the flower, other than this billion-dollar market that I was writing about in the book Too High to Fail. So that led to what became the book Hemp Bound. And yeah, you're right. It was not so much that even all the applications were so futuristic. It was just rediscovering them had huge promise. So a huge amount of carbon emissions come from today's petrochemical based construction and building industry. Hemp has always been built with, there's 1,000-year-old hemp houses in Ireland. There's bees that bring male hemp pollen back to the hive to pack it into the entranceways. So they have really strong integrity because of a lot of traffic. So it's obviously a great building material. And, I never leave home without a little hunk of hempcrete because I love talking about hemp building. So that's just one example. If you want to get on the tech end, hemp-based supercapacitors for next-generation batteries, weaning us from environmentally degrading and often human rights violating rare earth mineral harvests. Getting us into next-generation energy is something that's important in my life. So really, in a sentence, what I was going for when I wrote Hempbound was the idea that regional communities, as opposed to stock market traded commodities or federal bureaucracies regulating for 300 million people in our country or a billion in China or whatever, actually regional communities controlling their own economies through various modes that include this concept of the multiplier effect, keeping more elements of production for any industry, but using hemp as sort of the spearhead since it was returning back from oblivion, right? So if you have farmers in North Dakota that are growing thousands and thousands of acres for, say, superfood seed, they might be part of a cooperative where everybody is benefiting from a centralized production facility. And that's to say everybody according to cooperative principles, meaning it's a regional thing. It's not going to shareholders somewhere else. So there's actually a reason to be invested in communities. So there's a philosophy that goes along with the natural kind of healing connotations, healing of the nation connotations that cannabis hemp has. So that was extremely fun to write that high altitude book, Hempbound. And besides hempcrete and supercapacitors, there was, you know, animal feed was discussed and elements like that. And then finally, that book came out and a lot of people started asking me, okay, well, what do I do if I want to do it? Like my father and mother are getting on in years and I'm Missouri. We have 60 acres in Missouri. And I don't know, I went to be a graphic designer. I didn't want to grow GMO soy, but which I get that all kind of stuff all the time. So I wrote and published in 2020, 420, 2020 is when it came out, the book American Hemp Farmer, which just runs through a season of regenerative farming, focusing on like 10 to 20 acres, but it could be mapped out for huge section farmers, like I said, in the Dakotas or the Montana, or down to backyard gardening. It was really kind of like a day in the life of each step of the season. So for planting day, almost every time I've ever planted with any kind of mechanized planter, there's complications. And so I just wrote about that kind of as a rookie, like how much of, you know, 12% of your planting day is planting and the rest is trying to get this time saver thing to actually work. So that's American Hemp Farmer. But I also talked about potential business models like cooperatives, not tearing down any kind of economic institutions that have been in place. It's just always economics evolve and evolving to this idea of digital age thinking, but community minded focus, regional focus. The goal of every enterprise is not to sell out some hedge fund. It's not to go public. It's not to be the Kmart of hemp seed oil or ganja. It's how about a really lucrative 18-person farm to product ganja company that, yeah, what I'd love to see is a regionalization of the economy with hemp cannabis leading it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's important to note too, when we talk about energy specifically, there's the environmental aspects of the ways we're sourcing energy now, which are largely very decentralized. Oil, you know, is difficult to obtain increasingly, but always has been and has always consolidated the economy around it. You know, Standard Oil in the day was one of the first trusts that had to be broken up. And of course, today, you know, incredible consolidation in the oil and gas industry with these huge multinational corporations. When you flick the light on in your home, that energy in essence could be coming from so, so far away, but also so much of the conflict on our planet right now is driven by the scarcity of these existing forms of energy. And when something is scarce, there's a disproportionate value to it. And when there's enough value on something, unfortunately, people are willing to go to war to obtain it and secure it and to maintain their power over it. And so, in essence, the idea of these localized hemp economies is not just that it would produce energy in a much more environmentally friendly way, but that it would de-escalate conflict around things like oil that are currently, you know, driving our economic activity on the planet.
Oil and gas, certainly, but also I live in close to the mining, a lot of mining industry stuff, and those are, you know, completely just monstrous anonymous conglomerates. So yeah, we got to take, it's got to fight for your right to party, David.
Who are some of the interesting people you've met in charting this new movement towards a return of hemp?
One of the most exciting elements for me is when I've met independent farmers, whether they're from farming families or new first-time farmers, who actually are implementing this model of farm to product, hustling how they have to get it out to the world, but regeneratively done, all the revenue from the company staying within their community, and then they're taking it to the streets, whether it's farmers markets, CSAs, food cooperatives. They'll either write and send me an email, or I'll meet them at conventions and I'll think, this is a thing. It's not a dream. This is actually happening. As long as you can stick with it. These days, stick-to-itiveness is a, I don't want to say a rare trait, but it's such an important trait. People can't believe, oh, you're still doing that? You were talking about that 3 years ago. I was like, yeah, doing that forever. Actually, so, you know.
Yeah, well, we talk about propaganda by the word a lot, and then there's propaganda by the deed, which is where this journey ultimately took you, to plant your own hemp and to become, in essence, a working model of this vision that you've been championing. So moving into your next book, give me what is the life? How are you living right now? And how is hemp integrated into that?
I and my family are not food independent, but that's really what we do. We live here trying to inch towards food security as a family, and then spread that message through books and televisions and television and speaking. Growing your food, growing your plants, growing your herbs is obviously a human right without a doubt. And even though any limits on home cultivation of anything is a broach on human rights, for folks who may be hearing this and wanting to, you know, be active for final legalization in their state or country, home cultivation, in addition to any kind of dispensaries and commercials, home cultivation with no records, no filing, no government doesn't know anything about it, of a certain number of plants is an imperative. There is no legalization unless it includes full right to home cultivation. That's not something that can be taken away. And on that subject of home cultivation, just tying up one quick loose end, I loved what you were saying about how much you appreciated the pressed Mexican that you would get and that was available to you when you were discovering this plant that humans have enjoyed forever. And I love the idea of this middle ground. Since I live in New Mexico, I speak to people who are multi-generational, you know, from here. And they're always like, can you get us some Kush seeds? You know, man, grow some dank indigo. I'm like, dude, the native seeds here are fantastic. You just, you know, grow them nicely. It would end up as pressed seeded Mexican if that's how you treated it. But if you grow it and love it, it's wonderful sativa. It's a climate for sativa too. And outdoors, you know, like you said earlier, thank heavens for all the ganja farmers who got us ganja during prohibition by any route. And come on. If you locked up your kid and never let your kids see the sunlight, they'd take your kids away. It's free. I love your Zoom background here of this three-dimensional outdoor. The sun's free, and that's what your plants want. I would never want to eat any food that I grew indoors.
Yeah, you know, and I think that is an important point. You know, that was the move to grow cannabis indoors was a factor of prohibition. And, you know, if you have come to believe that quality cannabis is indoors because of how it looks, or maybe how even it smells, there's real science to say, you know, it's more about appearances than about the chemical composition of the plant, which is what you're actually bringing into your human body. So the old ways in so many things, the wisdom of generations past is not to be dismissed. And I think that's a lesson we're collectively learning when it comes to cannabis in all forms. And I would say maybe what excites you the most right now around hemp? Is there any specific project or movement that you think points towards the future?
I love that. I'll answer about a couple of personal projects I'm excited about. But first, I'll just say, trend-wise, one of the things I appreciate is that the industry appears to be moving beyond the short play of cannabinoids and CBD and thinking more about superfood and fiber applications. There's fiber projects in multiple states in the U.S. Progress on obvious things like building code stuff. For hemp, anytime there's a new material, there's building code stuff. And then likewise, food safety approved stamp of approval stuff with regard, especially to things like livestock feed is a laborious project that some good folks are involved in. And it's an important one. Personally, I haven't sought out indigenous projects, but almost all of the advising and consulting work that I do has been done with both Native American tribes and indigenous communities around the world. So I'm excited that it kind of in the hopper and the just getting going now are some projects on soil building and soil cleanup and seasonal agriculture in Alaska. Military legacy cleanup in Alaska. And just recently I'm back from a first field visit and soil testing, a really exciting project in the Yucatan in Mayan country. And one of the funnest parts about that for me is that obviously being successful agricultural economy for, you know, millennia, there's Mayan words for all the different kinds of soil that they have there. They have a lexicon for soil and what's good to grow where. So it's fun to be both introducing hemp, but also to be experiencing the local indigenous crops, the bean, various beans and jicama and stuff like that. Plus, I mean, awesome to be working in the Yucatan.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, that brings me to something I kind of wanted to bring things home with after this fascinating discussion, you know, and I encourage people to really delve into your books to truly understand the transformative potential of, as you say, not just cannabis and hemp, but a reimagining of our food systems and our energy systems. You know, obviously, most people listening to this podcast are not constitutionally or economically going to be able to just immediately jump in and start growing a lot of hemp. But I feel like the message "smoke weed every day" had a great spokesperson and has gotten out there. But make the case to bring us home for eat hemp every day.
Hemp is a genuine superfood with upwards of 30% protein and what many nutritionists consider the ideal ratio of omega 9, 6, and 3 fatty acids. It's also very high in minerals that it's hard to find otherwise in vegetarian foods in particular, such as magnesium and selenium, and gamma linoleic acid, which is difficult to find in any foods at all, which is a documented anti-inflammatory compound. And we kind of live in an inflamed society. So for those nutritional reasons, I suggest eating hemp every day, and I sure eat hemp every single day. Whole seeds that we grow here, but hemp hearts from our organic farmers in our Southwest region, and hemp seed oil that's been pressed from crops that I've grown infused with some cannabinoids that's my commercial product, and I use that every day in my coffee and tea and stuff. So I'm always eating it, but as important as the nutritional elements are, and this is not just hemp, not just food, all of our lives, the decisions that we make when we are, as you say, not the farmer, but someone who's purchasing it, it makes all the difference in the world. If you decide that you're going to actually have fun and go to that farmer's market or that food co-op to find who's your regional cultivator of a hemp seed or a CBD product or whatever it is, ganja, whatever, as opposed to saying, you know what, it'll be 7 cents a pound cheaper at a corporate box store. Those kind of decisions in our lives, I think, are the decisions that may make the difference between humanity thriving versus not as we head into the post-petroleum era.
Wise words. And, another thing we like to say here on Great Moments in Weed History is smoke the cannabis you want to see in the world. which sounds counterintuitive to light something on fire in order to preserve its existence. But of course, if you are sourcing the cannabis that you are ingesting and inhaling and rubbing on yourself from the kind of family farms that are responsible members of their community, that are growing in an environmentally responsible or even regenerative way, then that's just going to bring more of that cannabis into the world. And so I will add an addendum and I will say, eat the hemp you want to see in the world as well. I'm getting a big thumbs up from our guest. Doug, always a pleasure to spend any time with you, and especially to share your journey and your insights with everyone here at Great Moments in Weed History. I got to ask you our final question in your long journey with this plant in all forms. What stands out to you? We say great moments in weed history happen to all of us. Where would you so far say would be a highlight of your weed journey?
Thank you for that, and it's great to be on the show, and it's been a fantastic conversation. Thanks so much for having me. I've been a fan of the show, David. So and I'm glad that I've known you now for probably 10 years or more. It's hard to pick, but it was surprising to me when Dean Norton, the head of Director of Horticulture at Mount Vernon, asked me to guess what George Washington's most important and profitable use of hemp was. And I must have guessed 20 wrong answers. His number one application for hemp was fiber woven into fishnets that his boats would move across the Potomac. And he made the equivalent of today of millions of dollars in sturgeon and other fish that he harvested with hemp fishing nets in the Potomac. So learning that bit of history, bit of the cannabis plant, how valuable this plant is. It's the kind of thing that empowers one to go and talk about the health of this plant and biomaterial based economy in a Baptist church or, you know, in a Hindu community across the pond or whatever. You have history and truth on your side. And thank you for continuing to shout it out all the time.
That's what we're here for. Oh, Doug, thank you. And to everyone, thank you for joining us for this episode. And we will see you next weed for an all new episode of Great Moments in Weed History. Well, that's the show, folks. Thanks so much for listening. And if you stuck around this long, please consider supporting us on Patreon. You could put $5 on it at greatmomentsinweedhistory.com. And that would really help us as we research, write, edit, and publish a new episode every Weedness Day. Great Moments in Weed History is written, produced, and performed by me, David Bienenstock, a.k.a. Bean. Special thanks to our sponsor, PAX. Go to PAX.com and use promo code GREATMOMENTS, all one word, for a big discount at checkout.